First, there was the land. Then people came to the land and established a farm. At the center of the farm, they built a barn. And that barn leads us to ask, what did you learn in the barn of your youth?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 785th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, were you lucky enough to have a barn in your youth? I had one. It was a big red barn, big enough to be a landmark. At least it was along Dutch Lane outside of the little village of Belfry, Montana. Of course, I have since grown up and moved on, as has agriculture. But as if flipping the finger of defiance at industrial agriculture, that big red barn of my youth still stands. Everything else is gone. Farmhouse, vegetable garden and fruit orchard, corrals, pastures and fields, equipment, animals and people, all plowed under for government-subsidized sugar beets. But that big red barn, weathered and listing, still stands. You can see it on the front page of my website, which is metrofarm.com. Like most everyone else raised on a pre-industrial farm, I look back to the life and living experienced on the farm with awe. The barn, you see, was the center of the farm. Oh, to be certain, there was the farmhouse where we ate and slept, but that farmhouse and its activities was only peripheral to the farm. The real life and living of the farm took place in the barn, where people, animals, and crops came together in a symphony of survival. For a boy of six, the barn contained 1,000 Disneylands worth of adventure. In reading through The Round Barn by Jacqueline Dugan Jackson, and in considering the life and living experienced in the barn, I simply must ask, what did you learn in the barn of your youth? Here to help us explore that barn, we have Jacqueline Dugan Jackson herself. So pleased to have you aboard. Jackie, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Jackie, I got this great big book, The Round Barn. Somebody gave it to me, and I looked at it and thought, oh, my God, it will take me 100 years to read this. And then one day I opened it up and just picked out one story. And I thought, oh, my God, it's a pearl in a book of pearls. So you don't have to read the whole thing. You can pick it up and just open it up to any story that you want.
That's true.
And it's a fun read. And you can spend, it's the perfect bathroom book, right?
I think so, yes.
So, and it's a wonderful story. So, first of all, you were raised on the Dugan farm near Beloit, Wisconsin.
Yes.
Well, what about that farm? Tell us a little bit about it.
My grandfather bought it in 1906. He was a minister. He had grown up on a farm. He became a minister. He lost his hearing and realized that he needed hearing for his parishioners, and so he chose as his second ministry to produce clean milk for babies, because at the turn of the last century, many, many children and babies died because of impure milk.
Brucellosis.
And all sorts of the diseases and the germs and the things that would get in the milk.
Mm-hmm.
And so cleanliness was sort of, you know, godliness was pretty high, but maybe cleanliness was even ahead of it on our farm. And Grandpa built a round barn in 1911. He went there in 1906, and he did something unusual in the round barn, in that he painted the aims of this farm on the inside silo, which was the core of the round barn.
Which, of course, we're going to get to here in a little while. But I want to go back to your grandfather's deafness, which had a lot to do with this book.
Yes.
Did it not? In what respect?
Well, because Grandpa was deaf, people learned to write to him. And he would also often write out his thoughts in order to talk to his son or to somebody else ahead of time. And he was also an inveterate record keeper, which my father became too. And they didn't throw things out. So I have a tremendous archive of things from the farm, not only what I myself experienced growing up, but what happened before I was born, and when I wasn't there, and when I wasn't around, and afterwards, so that I have all this incredible amount of material on this one farm, which is, in a sense, a prototype, a typical Midwestern farm, in that it was a bit more than typical, because it was not only a dairy farm raising the cows, but we also processed the milk and peddled the milk in Beloit, Wisconsin, which was a little over a mile away. So that we did everything from the raising of the crops to feed the animals to the milking of them to the, well, the breeding of them, of course, and then the milking of them and the processing the milk and then peddling the milk in town.
And thus you were one of those vertically integrated agricultural enterprises.
We saw the thing from beginning to end. And I remember when I visited the shoe factory that I wanted to visit and came home puzzled, having been interested, because we peddled milk in the shoe factory. And at the table I was saying about how, you know, the mass production, one person stamping out a toe all day long. And my sister said, well, it's just the same here. We do the haying, we do this, and we do that. And I say, yes, but it's different. It's all, every time it's different. And there's a rhythm to it and a you know, it isn't doing just one thing. And what I realized then is that we saw the shoe, so to speak, from the very beginning to the very end. We saw the whole process.
Thus giving credence to Jefferson's notion that the farmer must be the smartest one of all, because
yes,
they have to
mm-hmm.
know everything from beginning to end.
And we were in on the exciting times of the start of hybrid seed corn and the start of artificial insemination.
Mm-hmm. The beginning of the Green Revolution.
Yes, we were in on the ground floor of all that. And so I was an early detasseler, and that was the corn. And with the ABS, my father got onto one of the early boards of the breeding, and we were the second co-op in the country of artificial breeding there in Rock County. The first was in New Jersey, and they'd brought the technique over from Denmark. So that I grew up with cow breeding and corn breeding, as well as milk. So that it was sort of the full picture, you know, milk and grain.
Lots of living and loving and dying on the farm, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That's lots of life. Well, now, when you were a wee child, you made your grandfather a promise.
When I was about 15... I had been interested in writing since I was a little kid and had written things. And I told him I was going to write him a book and call it The Round Barn. And Grandpa studied what I'd written down. I could spell on my hands, too, but I'd written that down. And he nodded and nodded over that piece of paper. And he said, yes, he said, The Round Barn will have a lot to say. And in a sense, that gave me my point of view, that the view was going to be from The Round Barn. It had to come from Jackie, through the Round Barn through Jackie, but that it could contain all sorts of things that Jackie didn't even know. So I interviewed people eventually when I wrote down four or five of the choice family stories at that point, but then my life went on and I did other things and other sorts of writing, and so it's taken me really all my life to bring the book to this final accumulation, and of course I could keep on with it forever. With there's so much more that could go in it. That isn't
7 billion stories from the Red Barn.
Yeah,
and it's because, of course, the barns are so full of life, which is the subject of today's program. It's not just life, and it's not just a living, but it's a way of living, and that's what we're going to be talking about. Experience. You went on to become a creative writing professor at the University of Illinois.
Yes.
And a radio host. Tell us about your radio show.
Well, I had a show out of the University of Wisconsin called The Author Is You, and then we transferred it down to Illinois when I got the job down there, and it was running at both places for a while, and then when the School of the Air quit up here in Wisconsin, up there. We kept on so that for 20 years I had this writing show where I would have three preparatory programs talking about different topics, and kids would write them in, and then the fourth week we would read what kids had sent in, so that every classroom that sent in a bunch of stories, we would read something from that classroom.
Well, folks, on the barn, in the silo, at the center of the silo in the round barn, was written the aims of this farm. 1, good crops. 2, proper storage. 3, profitable livestock. 4, a stable market. 5, life as well as a living. When we get back, we're going to hear a taste of life as well as a living from the Round Barn by Jackie Dugan Jackson. So don't touch that dial. Stay tuned for a taste of real life from a real farm. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, you know, the farms of our pre-industrial agriculture were not just about making a living. They were about having a life, a family, raising families, people, animals, crops, all together, surviving. And to have a taste of what that life was like, we're going to go to a book called The Round Barn by Jacqueline Dugan Jackson and have a taste of Thanksgiving dinner. Jackie, go ahead.
Well, the family and the hired men are all sitting at the big table in the farmhouse, and after Grandpa has given a lovely Thanksgiving grace, why, he says, "It gives me great pleasure to show you that everything on our Thanksgiving dinner has been grown on this farm." And Grandma says, "Well, that's so." And then Jackie begins looking around. Dominating the table are the Thanksgiving chickens sharing a huge platter, three of them golden brown and crackling, with steam escaping from a tender breast where Grandma's fork has pierced. Because of Grandpa's word, Jackie sees the food and its source at the same time. It's more than a double exposure, however. It's a series of pictures in such quick succession that they seem to be seen all at once with sounds and smells and feelings rolled in. She sees the hens as chicks, adorable fluffy balls, as gawky, half-feathered younglings, as grown hens purling and prowling around the woodpile by the big house kitchen door and racing when she comes with scraps, as laying hens sitting sharp-eyed and sharp-beaked in their hen boxes in the hen house, herself reaching cautiously under a puffed bosom to ease out an egg. She sees the chopping block and a headless chicken running crazily like a balloon blown up and let go. She sees Grandma plucking and singeing and pulling out all the insides, setting aside the heart and liver for giblet gravy, and with one swift stroke cutting open the gizzard to remove the gravel. She remembers the time she stood in amazement, her eyes scarcely above the marble tabletop, as Grandma pulled shell-less yellow yolks out of a chicken, a whole sequence of them starting with almost usual size, and then gradually smaller and smaller till there was a tiny, itty-bitty round yolk not as big as a teardrop. And at her request, Grandma gathered up those never-to-be-laid eggs down to the tiniest and poached them for her breakfast. And then all the vegetables. The golden mountain of Hubbard squash with a peak of snowy mashed potato beside it, both with boulders of butter melting down their sides, the tureen of creamed onions, the sliced carrots swimming in cream and butter, the cucumber pickles, the cabbage slaw, the bowl of stewed tomatoes. She sees superimposed the garden in all its seasons, the long row of feathery carrot tops, the tangled masses of squash and cucumber and pumpkin vines with their gaudy flowers, the rough-leaved potato plants spattered with the yellow-striped potato bugs she loathes to pick off but is sometimes ordered to. Strawberry jam and ruby red currant jelly share a divided dish. She sees the strawberry beds with their glimpses of red, and at the edge of the garden, the hedge of bushes laden with sour red currants, each as translucent as jelly, but with faint little stripes from top to bottom like a beach ball, and with a little pip of something on the top left over from the flower. The hedge and garden stop at the orchard, and there are rows of gnarled trees, all good for climbing and making separate houses, all bearing different sorts of apples with different tastes and different consistencies, Snows and Hubbardsons and Northern Spies and Wallingfields and big fat Northern Greenings for pies and Daddy's favorite apple, Eastern Maiden's Blush. In the fall, after they're gathered, the potatoes and carrots and turnips and apples and squashes and pumpkins and parsnips are stored in her most private, most special place on the entire farm, in the part of the basement beneath this table, the dirt-flowered, pungent root cellar, where she goes during the fall and winter from time to time, just to stand in the dim light of the single bulb amid the bins and bushel baskets and breathe deep breaths in dizzy ecstasy. There are the breadstuffs of the meal, the stuffing and the chickens, made with onions and celery and sage and butter and the plump hot rolls. Grandma is explaining about the flour. Jackie knows it comes from town in sacks that Grandma turns into dish towels after a hired man has poured the flour in a sneezy cloud of dust into the big square flour box beside the stove. Jackie and the others always perch on this box to be able to see what's going on, yet be out from underfoot. "But we never buy a lick of bread," says Grandma. "I make all those loaves every other day, enough to feed our house and Ronald's, too. So even though we buy the flour and the yeast, we produce ourselves all the bread and cakes and pies and cookies we ever use. And the jellies, there's sugar to buy. Daddy forgot that. But that's all. And I even make my own mincemeat." Only last week, Jackie had watched Grandma mince up the meat for the mincemeat, beef from a butchered cow, and helped cut up the apples and raisins and drunk in the heady fumes as she stood over the kettle stirring the dark mixture. And later she'd watched Grandma roll out the pie dough made with lard rendered from a butchered pig. And last of all on the table, rising like the barn's central silo above the other dishes, is the tall white china pitcher of milk, and clustered below it, the other dairy products, the cream, the butter, the cottage cheese. Later there would be whipped cream mounded on the mince and pumpkin and apple pies. Grandpa is right. It's all from the farm. You can quibble if you want about the flour and the raisins and the coffee that the grown-ups will drink after their pie. You can waggle your finger at the salt and pepper, as her brother is doing. But these are small matters. They have really grown all the food for their Thanksgiving meal right at home. "The Lord, of course, gives the increase," says Grandpa, "but none of this bounty would be here without the daily efforts of each of us. It is the fruit of our labor, and for this I am truly thankful." "Amen," agrees Mother. Everyone laughs and nods and starts passing the laden dishes.
Wow. That, from The Round Barn, a biography of an American farm by Jacqueline Dugan Jackson. Tell us a little bit about Wisconsin, Jackie, for those of us who have not been there. Just describe the land.
Well, in my part of Wisconsin, it was glaciated so that there are very gently rolling hills, and a little farther north are eskers and things like that. The land is very rich from the glaciation. Some of the best land in the world. Ours was Waukesha Loam over what? Anyway, it was like the Caucasus. And so that it grew very wonderful crops.
From where did the people come?
They came from different places. South of us in Rockford was heavily Swedish. Every time a Swedish king would show up or something, they'd go to Rockford. But the Swiss were over there in New Glarus. And so there were Swiss there. And, you know, they had round barns before we did. But our round barn was the product of Franklin King up at the University of Wisconsin, who was promoting round barns. And my grandpa, who was a university graduate, went up and studied the round barn and saw one that had been built. So that was where our round barn came from. And
your family?
Our section was...
Where did your family come from?
Ulster, really. Scottish-Irish. But my grandmother came over from England when she was 6 months old. And they settled up near Chilton. And the father, who was a builder in England, walked through a field of grass in the late summer, and it looked good, and he bought the farm, and they discovered in the spring that it was filled with tiny stones, or fist-sized stones, which the children had to haul out. And what did he do? He went down to Chicago and helped rebuild Chicago after the fire, whereas the kids were left to do the farming. My grandma was a baby, but it made a lasting impression on the oldest son, who hated farming.
And then, and as do most kids who are stuck working on farms, you know, I mean, that happened to me. I hoed so many weeds when I was a kid. I was a teenage herbicide, you know, couldn't wait to get away. But looking back, not so certain. And having listened to what your Thanksgiving dinner was like, oh my God, what a treat. Yeah. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. When we get back, we're going to talk barns, and the barns of the Dugan family farm in Wisconsin, and perhaps your family farm, wherever that might have happened to be. I talked with a good friend here at the station and asked her what she learned in her farm in Scotland, and she said, lots, right?
Yes,
back.
Lots.
Well, folks, for a young boy of six or so, the barn contained 1,000 Disneylands worth of adventures. Oh, my goodness. In reading through The Round Barn by Jackie Dugan Jackson, and in considering the life and living I experienced in the barn, I simply must ask you, what adventures did you have in the barns of your youth? What did you learn there? If you had the opportunity to experience a barn in your youth, you know what I'm talking about. You know all of the things that happen in the barn. Jackie, what did you learn in the hayloft of that barn?
Well, in the hayloft, I learned to avoid the chutes because they were open, and my father had once accidentally gone down one and broke both his heels.
Yeah.
So we learned to be very careful of that. But we were allowed to play in the hay. We weren't allowed to play in the straw sack outside because we would make holes in it, which would then catch water, and it had been made to shed water.
Mm-hmm.
So the hay was in the barn.
So boys and girls in the hayloft.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And a friend of mine said, you know, well, wasn't there any sex on the farm? What happened? Weren't there any rolls in the hay? So I've had to write a story about rolls in the hay later on. And
don't stop now. Tell us.
Well, I didn't go very far, but I was sitting up there with a young boyfriend about eighth grade. He had his arm around my shoulder, and one of the hired men came up to pitch down straw, and I'll never forget the smirk on his face as he went around pitching down straw, and Don and I sitting there just sort of stiff, and we were quite innocent at that point. But at least I managed to put in some sex in that chapter. And, of course, you knew sex from all the animals.
You're living around...
And living around then.
Sakes,
and I learned the facts of life, actually, from the artificial inseminator. He explained the whole thing to me from beginning to end. And I also learned in the barn. I came in once when the vet was there, and he was cleaning a cow. And he said, would you like to try it? And I said, sure. So he put the big sleeve on my arm and had me reach down inside the cow's vagina and feel around for what they called the buttons and to unloosen the afterbirth that hadn't yet come out. Usually it comes out on its own. If it doesn't, why the farmer does it. Or if the farmer can't manage, why then the vet comes and does it. So I unbuttoned a cow, and, of course, my sister was appalled. She said, well, what did you do that for, Jackie? And I said, well, the cow needed it, and it was interesting. And my main feeling, besides being down there in this long passageway, was how warm it was. And I thought, why, that cow is all warm inside, you know, which wasn't, it shouldn't have surprised me, but it did.
You know, it's a wonderful description. Recently, the general manager of the local fair told me the story about how he was getting ready, the fairgrounds ready for the annual fair. And he happened to have some kids out, some, I don't know what the juvenile delinquents, I don't know what the proper word for them is these days, but that's what they were. And they were out there, you know, working, cleaning up the grounds. And they had all managed to gather around a corral where a young 4-H girl was milking a cow. And, you know, kind of somewhat concerned, he went up there to see what was going on. And there she was milking the cow. And all of these city kids were just standing there with their mouths ajar in total amazement. My God, that's where milk comes from. So we do learn about life and living in the barn.
I learned routine in the barn, too. I mean, Of course, we had routine in the house, too, but the routine in the barn had to be, you know, the milking had to be done at a certain time, and the milk had to be promptly cooled and up to the milk house and to be bottled, and the feeding and the cleaning and the whole daily, what I call the song of the round barn, in one of my pieces. There was this routine, and I said that anywhere on the farm where my sisters and my brother and I were, if anybody asked us what was going on in the barn, we could tell them, because we knew what the barn routine was. And I think it taught a kind of discipline that you don't get in school by having this kind of life. And Grandpa always said, you know, about crops, you know, planting the right thing at the right time with the right tools. And so we knew what the right time was. And I have some notes from my father from the summer of 47, where it just rained and rained and rained and rained, and he's keeping track of when people were trying to plow, and the terrible time of trying to get the seed in between the weather, and finally managing and losing some, but getting some in. And I finished that chapter. He mostly was keeping records in it rather than a diary. And so this is a record of a atypical, typical year on the farm.
Which is,
because every year was atypical.
Yep. You have this wonderful, speaking of routines, you have this wonderful description of Grandpa standing in his window early in the morning, waiting to make certain that the light in the barn went on time.
Yes. And one of the I interviewed a lot of the people from the farm, and Red Richardson said this had become a line in their family, that if Grandpa didn't see the light in the barn, even though if it was Red's day off, he would have somebody telephone up to Red's house and say, no lights in the barn. And Red would have to leap out of bed and come the quarter mile from where he was living.
So he's the foreman?
He was one of the barn workers at that time. He might have been the herdsman. But he said that became their family line for emergency. No lights in the barn.
No lights in the barn. The world is coming to an end. You know, I had putting together a book on a World War II Navy destroyer, I asked one of the officers once, you know, where do you get the best sailors? And without a millisecond of a hesitation, he said, from the country, you give me a farm boy any day, I will make a sailor out of them. City boys, you can keep them. Give me that farm boy.
They learn a rhythm and a discipline, and when things need to be done, and the importance of having them done when they need to be done.
Is there a big difference between work and play? I mean, thinking back to my youth on a farm, you were always working and you were always playing.
Well, this was my experience. We didn't have to milk the cows the way my father did when he was little. There were a milking machine and hired men. And we had some of our jobs. We, you know, had to pick potato bugs, and we helped in the garden and shelled peas and things like that. And then when I was tall enough, I was detasseling corn. But there was a satisfaction in knowing you were doing something worthwhile and something that mattered. And what I have found about work and play is that the words are they meld together. That if you are enjoying what you're doing, even if it's hard work, even if you're sweating, even if your stomach is hurting, as it would when I was detasseling, because you had to pull up and that made a jerk on your stomach, it was play as well as work. And I've written a chapter called Play, where I say the farm was just one vast playground, but it included work. But it was just an incredible place to grow up.
And are there any places like that left to grow up?
There's got to be some. And I think that some of these organic farms and some of these, we have farms around Springfield that are attempting to carry on a farm life in the old tradition.
Hey, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We are talking the Round Barn with Jacqueline Dugan Jackson and you. Did you grow up with a barn? 831-479-1080. As if flipping the finger of defiance at industrial agriculture, the big red barn of my youth still stands. Everything else is gone, the farmhouse, vegetable garden and fruit orchard, corrals, pastures and fields, equipment, animals and people, all plowed under for government-subsidized sugar beets. But that big red barn, weathered and listing, still stands. What about Jackie's barn? The big red barn of Jackie's youth in Wisconsin there, Beloit, Wisconsin. Does it still stand, Jackie?
It stood up until about a month ago. And at that point, since it wasn't being used and we had tried to save it, and I won't go into detail as to how we failed, we nearly saved it, the city finally tore it down because it was what was known as an attractive hazard for kids and so forth. And I was hoping that they would leave the silos standing, which weren't a hazard at all, but they took those down too.
So all gone.
It's all gone. And that section of Turtle Township has been pretty well wrecked up, too, because I-90 went through, and I-90 went right through the side of the farm, and you can hardly keep on farming a farm that's got the major highway going through it.
Mm-hmm.
They should have gone on the other side of town where there was just sand. Our side was... right through the beautiful...
Some of the best soil on earth.
Yes, and So we had moved a mile and a half up the road, so we had a couple of farms, and my father lived there till he died, and it was just recently that we sold that farm. But the Round Barn is gone, but this is my legacy, these books that are telling as much as possible about what it was like, and well illustrated with lots of pictures.
So then the Round Barn isn't gone at all, is it?
No, it's not. The heritage is there.
You can take the stones away, but you can't take the spirit away. In the barn, on the silo, your grandfather wrote, the aims of this farm, good crops, proper storage, profitable livestock, a stable market, life, as well as a living. What did he mean by life as well as a living?
He meant that the farm couldn't be all just back-breaking labor. It had to be something that enhanced people's lives. He wrote something in his early lives at the farm where he says, what is a farmer? And he gives definitions of other people's, and then he says, how about this one? One who tills the soil, conserving its fertility, builds real farm homes, and enhances rural community life. And I think that life as well as a living would be enhancing rural community life for everybody. And of all the people that I interviewed for this book, invariably, the various hired men, the visitors, the people that lived there and so forth, they would say that life as well as a living impressed them the most, because that was the way life was lived on the farm. And the hired men lived in the big house and took their meals with the family and were treated as family. And we were all, we were all in it together in a mutual enterprise
The symphony of survival.
Yes, yes. That's a good way of putting it.
Animals, crops, and people.
Right.
All together, mm-hmm. all in the barn, striving mm-hmm. to survive.
And basic crops. During the war, we had to raise hemp, by the way, the Second World War.
Oh, my God.
Because of and Grandpa hated it because it was so fibrous that it wrecked the farm machinery. It was always breaking the teeth on the things that would cut it and so forth. And then later, I've got a very funny story about marijuana where one of the farm people was raising some on their farm, and when they were caught, why, Loretta said, What? That's marijuana? I won't touch the stuff. They told her to destroy it. She said, that's illegal. I won't touch that stuff. And so I've got a very funny about marijuana. But at that point, it was a basic crop that we weren't getting from the Philippines.
Sure.
So and I have
a very valuable crop in many respects. And I just recently did a radio program with a fellow who's bound and determined to make it a $1 billion business, turning that crop into superfoods of one kind or another. So who knows where we're going with all of this? And where are we going with all of this? We've moved off the farm. We no longer have that place where we can, how did he put it, have a life as well.
Right. Very,
as
very few people are now living on farms. The farms have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And the rural population.
And those that do live on farms really don't live on farms. I mean, I just think about an interview I did with a farmer in North Dakota. And, you know, their farmhouse is kind of like the bridge of an aircraft carrier. It reminded me of that. They had all of this electronics equipment, and it was like they're directing things to happen over here on the south 1,000 acres over there. And it was like all kinds of different.
The artificial insemination, you could tell in a dairy barn when a cow was in heat, but you couldn't tell on a ranch where they were scattered all over, the beef cattle. And so in recent years, and maybe not so recent, the cows would have a chip on them, and the computer would be up in the farmhouse. And if somebody tried to mount a cow out there, why, that would show, that steer is in, well, whatever it was. Anyway, they could tell by the computer, couldn't have been a steer, when a cow had to be inseminated, and then they could send the inseminator out or round up the cow and bring it in. So there were all these remarkably modern ways of handling things.
And when we get back with Jackie Dugan Jackson, where do we go from here now that we no longer have that place where we can have a life as well as a living, where our agriculture has become industrialized so that no longer do families live on a farm? Where do we go to have that life? We will be right back. Thank you for tuning in. Well, I bet if you were raised on a farm, you have a story and stories and probably millions of stories about your life in a barn. I certainly do. Anybody who was raised on a farm with a barn probably does, because that was the center of the farm. And that's the subject of today, the barn, and specifically the Round Barn, a biography of an American farm with Jackie Dugan Jackson. Jackie, you brought some guests. Would you like to introduce them for us?
Yes, I have my daughter, Megan, and my son-in-law, Michael. And they live out here in California. And Megan is my able art editor and very capable and has drawn the maps and some of the other drawings. Most of the book is photographs, but she's done some very fine drawings, and so I'm awfully happy
and
to have her.
And she's very adamant that we tell people where to find copies, their copies of The Round Barn, which I highly commend. Folks, this is a book that you can read bits at a time, and I'll guarantee you walk away with a big smile and a warm feeling in your heart. Megan, where do we find a copy of The Round Barn?
The book is available on our website, roundbarnstories.com. The website is also a good visit because there are a couple of little videos, including a cinematic advertisement that would have been shown prior to the movie, made in 1932, and also a dance recital which shows Jackie at age 4 dancing on the lawn.
And Mike, welcome aboard. You got something to say too?
You're listening to the best radio station in the world, KSCO, 1080 on your dial.
Good plug here. And also the Food Chain radio program heard throughout the United States as well. Jackie, you're going to tell us a story to close it out. Fire away.
Okay, well, I learned a lot about cow sicknesses and illnesses, traveling with the vet and being in the barn and so forth. But one night I was down, we had a farm a mile and a half up from the Round Barn farm that we were living on at that time, and my goat was out in the barn, and I went down to put her to bed and be sure she was okay. It was 20 below zero, wanted to be sure she had water. And I noticed in the box stall next to my goat that here was a cow lying down. And when I looked at her more closely, I saw that there were two little hooves sticking out of her vulva. And nothing was happening. And I raced up to the house and got my dad, and he came down, and the two of us tried to pull this calf out, to give birth to this calf that was just there. And we couldn't manage. We got Craig, my brother, and the three of us did, and it was sort of like the fairy story of pulling up the radish where they had everybody in a row. And we finally got the calf out, and it was dead. It had too much strangulation of the umbilical cord around the neck for too long. But then the problem was the cow. We banked her up with straw and with newspapers and everything to keep her warm. But at 20 below zero, it's very hard. And so the next day I looked at her, and that night I looked at her, and my grandpa came and looked at her, and he explained to me about birthing paralysis, which is what this cow had, which is the pinching of the nerve. And finally, when I came, the cow was gone. And my grandfather was around, and I asked him about it. And he said it had to be shipped, that they couldn't manage any longer. And he said, on a farm, he said, where there is livestock, there is dead stock.
And a tough lesson to learn, but those of us who are raised on a farm learn it really early. And learn it all the time. Where there is life, there is death. And where there is death, there is life. On the Farm, The Round Barn, a biography of an American farm with Jacqueline Dugan Jackson. Pick up a copy, folks, and treat yourself to a little bit of real living on a farm. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember to tune in next week for more What's Eating What Radio. And remember, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.